When Thomas Jefferson penned the American Declaration of Independence in July 1776, he included the now famous line, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." I don't think that Mr. Jefferson was anticipating that some 230 years later, his words would be the inspiration for a movie starring Will Smith. But he did intend, I think, to provide a new vision for a new country, one founded on the rights of man and the rule of law, and with the prospect of elevating humanity to its highest social and political aspirations. With the benefit of hindsight, we can see that for most of America's history, rather than matching the idealism of Jefferson's words, the nation lived a hypocritical creed that afforded equality to whites, but not to non-whites. When the Constitution was written, only white men with property could vote. A few decades later, the vote was extended to all white men. After the Civil War, the slaves were freed and black men were given the franchise. It was not until 1920 that women achieved suffrage. If anything has been self-evident in the American narrative, it is that for most of the nation's history, the blessings of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness were truly guaranteed only to a portion of America's citizens. 45 years ago, when Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. spoke before a crowd of some 250,000 Americans who'd come to Washington, D.C. to march for jobs and freedom, he observed that America had given non-whites a bad check, a check which has come back marked insufficient funds. But he refused to believe that the Bank of Justice is bankrupt, that there are insufficient funds in the great vaults of opportunity in the United States. Reverend King outlined his dream that one day America would rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed, that all men are created equal. He had a dream that one day the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners would be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood. He had a dream that one day his four little children would live in a nation where they would not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. He had a dream that one day little black boys and black girls would be able to join hands with little white boys and white girls as sisters and brothers. 4 weeks ago, when so many of us stayed up all night watching the election returns, riveted to our televisions to see how rural Pennsylvanians and Rust Belt Ohioans and retired Floridians would vote, we witnessed Dr. King's dream taking one step closer to becoming reality. We saw what I believe was not just a profound and great moment for Americans and American history, but truly a watershed in world history. Whatever else it means, Barack Obama's election inverts traditional power relations and shatters the glass ceiling for non-white people around the world. If an African American or a Kenyan Kansan or whatever else we want to call him can become the most powerful man in the world, then there's no limit to what individual men and women around the world can achieve. African Americans in particular felt this in a unique and visceral way. In a CNN poll taken shortly after the election, 80% of African Americans said that Obama's election was a dream come true, and 71% said they thought they would never see a black elected president in their lifetime. For the first time since such polling has been done, a majority of blacks who previously believed that racism was bound to be a permanent fixture in the American experience now believe that a solution to the country's racial problems can and will be found. Another group of Americans supported Obama at nearly the same rate as blacks. While 93% of African Americans voted for Obama, a remarkable 89% of Muslim Americans did as well, according to a poll by the American Muslim Task Force on Civil Rights and Elections. In our mock election here on campus, by the way, 91% of AUCans voted for Obama. This election witnessed the highest American Muslim voter turnout ever reported, including 14% of Muslim voters who said this was their first ever trip to the ballot box. This rise in voter participation by Muslims indicates both a faith that they could fully participate in and contribute to American democracy, and a hope that in Barack Obama they had found a candidate who would be responsive to their concerns. Just as the 1932 election of Franklin Roosevelt marks the moment when African Americans began to switch in large numbers from the party of Lincoln to the Democratic Party, we may look back on the 2008 election as the time when Muslims solidly joined the Democratic Party coalition. Indeed, more than two-thirds of American Muslims now consider themselves Democrats, and only 4% say that they are Republican. Interestingly, it seems that by the time of the election, Muslim voters mirrored other Americans in terms of what issues most affected them. In January 2008, A poll of Muslim voters showed that education and civil rights were their top issues. But exit polls right after the November election revealed that 63% said the economy was the most important issue for them, followed by 16% who said that Iraq and Afghanistan were at the top of their list. These numbers are very similar to what we see in the broader electorate, and one interpretation is that American Muslims are largely in step with the attitudes of the rest of the country, and that when they went to the polls on November 4th, they were thinking of themselves more as Americans than as Muslims. It's been an interesting dance between Muslims and Obama. As you're well aware, for a considerable portion of America, the word Muslim, or for that matter Arab, constitutes something of a slur and is readily equated with terrorist. Muslim Americans who enthusiastically supported Obama were caught in a kind of political no man's land. As one Muslim woman quoted in a Newsweek article said, "Yes, I want to shout my endorsement of Obama from the rooftops, but I don't want to mess up any chance of Obama becoming the next president. How crazy is this position we've been put in?" Candidate Obama had to walk a very fine line between reaching out to Muslims and welcoming them into his coalition, but not associating with them too closely for fear of fueling the incessant internet and talk radio rumors of his secret Muslim identity. It was Colin Powell, not Barack Obama, who most famously made the point that the best response to the false accusation that Obama is a Muslim was not a hysterical denial, "No, he's not, he's a patriotic American Christian," but rather a "so what if he is" affirmation of America's tolerance for religious as well, for religious as well as racial diversity. While some Muslim Americans wanted Obama to more explicitly repudiate the Islamophobia that has settled in as a persistent fact of post-9/11 life in America, most understood his delicate position and were grateful for small victories. As one commented, "I remember during one of his rallies, it was reported that women in hijabs were asked to move out of the camera shot. When Obama found out what his staffers did, his response was to pick up the phone and call those women and apologize. That really resonated with me. What other politician would do that?" Just as it did for African Americans, Barack Obama's successful candidacy affirmed for many Muslims that full equality, regardless of race, nationality, or religion, was becoming less an American dream and more an American reality. But despite what many of his most zealous supporters seem to believe, however, President-elect Obama is not the Messiah. The deep problems facing America and the world are no different than they were a month ago. The incoming Obama administration has to deal with a faltering world economy, an overburdened and overexpensive healthcare system, two unpopular wars where the end is not in sight and victory is in doubt, a global climate crisis that will get worse before it gets better, and the certainty of future terrorist attacks and the possibility that they will involve nuclear or biological weapons. And that's not even considering the stress that President-elect Obama is under with the all-important decision of what kind of dog to buy his two daughters. Obama will become leader of a normally optimistic nation in which only 16% of people currently say things are going well in their country, an all-time low, with 83% saying things are going badly, an all-time high. He is fortunate to have the goodwill of most Americans, even many of those who voted for John McCain. According to a CNN poll, 2/3 of all Americans have a positive view of what Obama has done since he was elected president, and 3/4 think he will do a good job as president. President-elect Obama will need every bit of that goodwill and will need to translate it into political power because the challenges facing his administration are among the greatest that any incoming presidency will have to wrestle with in all of American history. The economy has not been this fragile since Franklin Roosevelt took over in the depths of the Great Depression in 1933, and he basically only had a domestic agenda to contend with, not a world immersed in any number of seemingly perpetual crises. As Obama himself conceded in his victory speech, the road ahead will be long, our climb will be steep. We may not get there in 1 year or even in one term. Because the list of obstacles is so long and the nature of so many of them is so deep, substantial progress will be difficult and not immediate. Indeed, perhaps the greatest challenge that Obama will face is the stratospheric expectations that his supporters in the United States and around the world will have for him. Just a sampling of congratulatory comments from world leaders is instructive as to how high the bar is set before Obama even lays his hand on the Bible and takes the oath of office on January 20th. President Karzai of Afghanistan called Obama's election the beginning of a new era for the world. Gordon Brown, Prime Minister of Great Britain, praised Obama for energizing politics with his progressive values and his vision for the future. Former South African President Nelson Mandela wrote in a letter to Obama, "Your victory has demonstrated that no person anywhere in the world should not dare to dream of wanting to change the world for a better place." And in what may be the closest thing to a love letter in international politics, Nicolas Sarkozy, the French president, offered his warmest congratulations and gushed, "Your brilliant victory rewards a tireless commitment to serve the American people. It also crowns an exceptional campaign whose inspiration and exaltation have proved to the entire world the vitality of American democracy. By choosing you, the American people have chosen change, openness, and optimism." The combination of unrealistically high expectations and extremely difficult challenges means that it's inevitable that Obama will disappoint. Indeed, it's almost impossible to imagine a scenario in which he could live up to expectations, especially among those who hope for quick and dramatic solutions to what are in fact complex and deep-seated difficulties. With that in mind, I want to discuss three things. First, why and how Obama won this election. Second, what happens now and what the impact of his election will be for the rest of the world, in particular the Middle East. And finally, what it means for the future of American politics and society. First, how did Obama win? Fundamentally, it should be recognized that conditions in the United States meant that it would have been very difficult for a Republican, no matter who it was, to have won this presidential election. George W. Bush has some of the lowest approval ratings of any president since they began keeping track. Exactly how low? Bush's approval rating bottomed out at 24%, tied only with Richard Nixon, who resigned in disgrace, as the lowest in the past half century. Perhaps more telling, his disapproval rating topped out at 76%, by far the highest of any modern president. I think even the new campus gets more favorable ratings than that. Americans, who the world has thoroughly enjoyed making fun of for the past 8 years after electing George Bush not once but twice, have mostly come to the conclusion that the war in Iraq should be ended sooner rather than later. They are not as riveted or intimidated by the rhetoric and to some degree reality of the war on terror as they were in 2004. And when the economy, which actually has not been doing all that well in recent years, took such a drastic downturn beginning this summer, precipitating a global financial crisis that threatens a depression with no parallel since the 1930s, it all but sealed the doom of the candidate running under the banner of the incumbent Republican Party. People will blame John McCain for either being too conservative or not conservative enough, or some point to his selection of Sarah Palin as a mistake. But the fact is that of all the Republican candidates, admittedly not their strongest field in history, McCain was probably best equipped for a serious run at the presidency this year, and Palin was neither going to win nor lose the election for him. Nevertheless, while John McCain would have had a hard time winning this election, especially in a political climate in which 57% of voters said the economy was their number one issue, it was a distinct possibility that Obama could have lost it. This is a fact we shouldn't lose sight of. Yes, the Republicans lost the election, but more than anything, Obama won it. How did he do so? Part of it was his message, focusing so intently on the twin themes of hope and change. His charisma captured the imagination of voters, particularly those who had grown apathetic or cynical about the political process. This appeal was especially strong among young voters who turned out in record numbers. And his 8.5 million vote margin in the popular vote suggests that the policies that Obama made central to his platform resonated with the greater share of American voters. But I would submit to you that the real reason Barack Obama won on November 4th is because he ran one of the best organized campaigns in the history of U.S. presidential elections. As noted in the New York Times the day before the election, the innovation and creativity and organization of the Obama campaign have already fundamentally changed the way in which campaigns will be waged in the future, in terms of how to reach voters, raise money, organize supporters, manage the news media, and mold public opinion, and wage and withstand political attacks. We may look back on this campaign and say that Obama won the election by and large on the web. He and his team used websites, blogs, YouTube, and all the resources of the so-called new media to attract new voters, disseminate his message, raise money, and mobilize his followers. Obama raised more money than any candidate in American history, some $640 million, $150 million in September alone. Much of this was donated by ordinary people giving $25 or $50 or $100, rather than the wealthy and corporate donors that politicians have typically relied on to fund their campaigns. This overabundance of money allowed Obama to spend with reckless abandon in the closing weeks of the campaign. He bought a 30-minute primetime spot on 7 national TV networks in the final week, and he outspent the McCain campaign 4-1 on TV ads in Pennsylvania, and that's a state McCain cared about. Furthermore, with people in their 20s more likely to get their news from the internet than from traditional television, radio, and print sources, Obama's complete domination of the web helped him capture a remarkable 66% of the voters between the ages of 18 to 29, up 12 points from what John Kerry got in 2004. The Obama website also featured a number of innovative features that allowed ordinary people to participate in the campaign and become invested in the democratic process through phone calls and door-to-door visits. In addition to his unprecedented web presence, Obama also did it the old-fashioned way, establishing field offices in cities and towns around the country, often penetrating deep into territory that had been reliably Republican for decades and had voted for Bush by wide margins in the last two elections. This was partly a function of Obama's decided financial advantage over the Republicans, but also because the extended Democratic Party primary campaign against a more prominent and well-established opponent in Hillary Clinton forced him to organize early and thoroughly. For instance, at the beginning of October, Obama had established 39 field offices in the usually solidly Republican state of Indiana, while McCain had exactly zero. Indiana, not coincidentally, went for Obama this election. This in a state that President Bush won by over 500,000 votes just 4 years ago. So now that Obama has translated this remarkably innovative and successful campaign into victory, what does he do now that he has to get down to the more difficult task of governing? Where should he place his time and energy? Admitting that things might change once he sits in the Oval Office for the first time, we have a clue of what he'll do based on an interview he gave to CNN the week before the election. Speaking with Wolf Blitzer, he outlined what his top 5 priorities would be upon coming to office, in order. Number 1, stabilize the financial system. Number 2, energy independence. Number 3, healthcare reform. Number 4, tax reform, including tax cuts for the middle class. Number 5, reforming the education system. Notice what's missing here. There's no mention of foreign policy. Now, of course, no U.S. president can ignore the rest of the world, although some have tried. In fact, President-elect Obama is very much interested in reshaping and reformulating U.S. foreign policy and improving America's relations and burnishing its image around the world. Most importantly, the world will press itself upon him. So even if Obama sincerely wanted to devote himself to reforming American education before looking beyond the borders, which I don't really believe he does, circumstances would not give him that luxury. America's ongoing military involvement in Iraq and Afghanistan will occupy the new president's attention from day one. A cornerstone of Obama's campaign was his promise to withdraw the majority of U.S. troops from Iraq within 16 months. But that is an immensely complicated issue that cannot, or at least should not, be done without a realistic assessment of facts on the ground and the flexibility to change plans according to circumstance, both flaws of the strategy under Bush, which helped to lead such a mess in the first place. In addition, last week's terrorist attacks in Mumbai, which have precipitated an escalation in tensions between nuclear neighbors India and Pakistan, will also compete for space at the top of the agenda. No president wants World War III, or at least nuclear war in the South Asian subcontinent, home to roughly a quarter of the world's population, to begin on his watch. And of course, there are many other issues in the international sphere, with headliners such as North Korea, Iran, loose nukes, China, and Russia, only the tip of the iceberg. Naturally, here in Egypt, most people are interested in what the Obama election means for the Middle East and for American relations with the Arab world. I haven't been home when President-elect Obama has tried calling to get my advice and to fill me in on what he's secretly planning to do, so I'll be forced to speculate a little bit in the next few minutes. As my mother often says, life is what happens when you make other plans. And despite all the plans and promises that Obama and his advisors make, they're constrained by a number of structural limitations within the American political system, as well as international geopolitical realities. In addition, changing circumstances and developing crises will force them to react in ways they may not have anticipated, meaning that even the sincerest of promises may go unfulfilled. One set of clues for how the new Obama administration will approach the Middle East can be found in looking at the profiles of some of the president's closest advisors. Yesterday, he announced his national security team. And while the cabinet-level positions need to be confirmed by the Senate, there's no reason to believe that there will be any problem with this, partly because there's a strong Democratic majority, but largely because he seems to have consciously chosen a team that will appeal or at least not be objectionable to people in both political parties. So let me walk through a few of his key political advisors, outline their particular relationship or perspective on the Middle East, and suggest what they may be saying to their boss about the region. Let's start with Joe Biden, the new Vice President of the United States. For those of you wondering about what exactly the Vice President of the United States does, you're not alone. Sarah Palin wasn't exactly clear on what the job description was for the job she was applying for. And a string of American politicians since the nation's founding have commented on the strangeness of the office, concerning which the Constitution gives precious little instruction. John Adams, the first Vice President, described it as the most insignificant office that ever the invention of man contrived or his imagination conceived. Thomas Marshall, who served as Vice President under Woodrow Wilson, quipped, "Once there were two brothers. One ran away to sea, the other was elected Vice President, and nothing was ever heard from either of them again." Before accepting the job, Theodore Roosevelt, who served under William McKinley and assumed the presidency after McKinley was assassinated in 1901, remarked in what is a heartwarming statement for me, "I would a great deal rather be anything, say, a professor of history, than Vice President." And finally, John McCain, who some rumored might be selected as George W. Bush's vice president in 2000, explained, "The vice president has two duties. One is to inquire daily as to the health of the president, and the other is to attend the funerals of third world dictators. And neither of those do I find an enjoyable exercise." Anyway, back to Joe Biden, who apparently just got the most irrelevant job in the world with not much to do except wait for your boss to die. I think Obama's selection of Biden as his running mate was not just a political ploy to appeal to the voters of Scranton, Pennsylvania, or even to shore up the foreign policy credentials of the Democratic Party ticket. Biden may not be the president's chief sounding board or principal advisor, but I do believe he will be an important voice at the table, especially given his considerable foreign affairs knowledge and experience of mastering his long years in the Senate. Because of his extensive service there, we have a pretty good record of Biden's views towards the Middle East. He places a premium on negotiation, including a willingness to talk with regimes such as Iran, enhanced with significant non-military aid where necessary and appropriate. He voted to authorize war on Iraq in 2002, but was opposed to using that authorization as an endorsement for the Bush doctrine of preemptive strikes. Once it became apparent that the situation in Iraq was not what the Pentagon and CIA had made it out to be, Biden became one of the Bush administration's harshest critics. He has suggested, though not adamantly, that a formal partition of Iraq, with three semi-autonomous regions operating under the umbrella of a central government, might be the best political solution for the country. He opposed the surge in Iraq and has called for a withdrawal of U.S. troops, while at the same time recognizing that what he calls a strategic surge might be useful in Afghanistan. More significantly, he proposes something like a Marshall Plan for Afghanistan, pointing out that despite its central strategic interest, the U.S. spends less per capita on reconstruction efforts in Afghanistan than it has in the Balkans or in East Timor. Massive foreign aid, upwards of $2.5 billion a year, should also be sent to Pakistan, Biden says, both to fight Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, and other terrorist groups, and to build schools, clinics, roads, and other infrastructure. Like all American politicians, Biden is opposed to Iran gaining nuclear weapons, but he also opposes regime change in Iran or the threat of a nuclear strike against it. While reserving the possibility of the use of force as an option, he emphasizes employing multilateral diplomacy as well as economic and diplomatic pressure. "The only thing worse than a poorly planned intentional war," he says, "is an unplanned, unintentional war, which could be sparked if the U.S. takes an overly belligerent stance towards the Iranians." So in short, given his long public record, we can say with confidence that in many ways Biden represents the broad, fairly responsible middle of American foreign policy, with a clear preference for diplomacy, but a willingness to use force when seen as necessary. More problematic from an Arab point of view is Obama's chief of staff, Rahm Emanuel, the son of an Israeli-born doctor who was once a member of the Irgun. Emanuel is a practicing Jew who one friend characterizes as being deeply and emotionally committed to Israel and its safety. It's something he talks about constantly. To give you a sense of that commitment, Emanuel was working on a campaign for Chicago Mayor Richard Daley when the first Gulf War broke out. He left his post with the campaign and volunteered for service in the Israeli Defense Force, where he apparently spent a few months rust-proofing brakes in northern Israel. He went on to serve as an advisor to President Bill Clinton for 6 years, then in 2002 was elected to the House of Representatives, where he quickly ascended to a position of leadership in the Democratic Party. Although typically a fierce Democratic Party partisan, Emanuel broke with his party to endorse President Bush's State Department in its support for pro-democracy activists within Arab countries, claiming the past administrations had given, quote, repressive regimes such as Egypt and Saudi Arabia a free pass. Emanuel personally escorted Obama when he gave a strongly pro-Israel speech before the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, or AIPAC, in Washington. And Emanuel set up a private meeting between Obama and AIPAC's executive board. President-elect Obama has promised to be actively engaged in the Palestinian-Israeli peace process from the beginning of his administration, but many Arabs fear, and I think with some justification, that Emanuel might nudge the president a little too far towards the Israeli side, which would undermine his credibility with the Arab world and surely set back negotiations, which already don't need much further discouragement. As Emanuel's father recently said in an Israeli newspaper article referring to his son, obviously he will influence the president to be pro-Israel. Why wouldn't he? Before I go any further, let me try and give a bit of perspective here. While Emanuel's outspoken and unflinching support for Israel does undoubtedly merit concern and will certainly affect the nature of advice he gives the president, the appointment of a strongly pro-Israel politician to a lofty position in the U.S. government isn't exactly a stop-the-presses moment. To say that an American politician is pro-Israel is about as unremarkable as saying that he or she has two eyes and ears. Sure, there are a few exceptions, but people look at them kind of funny. This is simply a fact of contemporary American politics and can be explained without any kind of resort to conspiracy theories. There are any number of factors that contribute to the close relationship between the United States and Israel, including Israel's political and economic orientation towards the West, America's desire to maintain a strategic partner in the Middle East, the democratic polities of both nations, the residual effects of post-Holocaust guilt in the West, and the disproportionate lobbying weight of the American Jewish community, to name just a few factors. Emanuel was chosen as chief of staff because of his incredible effectiveness as a political operator. His relationship to Israel is seen by most Americans, and apparently by Obama, as an interesting but unexceptional fact, certainly nothing on the magnitude of a potential deal-breaker. The precise nature of Emanuel's influence remains to be seen. On the one hand, he could, as a close advisor and the gatekeeper to the president, make access to the Oval Office by Arab and pro-Palestinian groups more difficult. On the other hand, his own deep personal interest in the region may well inspire him to push the peace process higher on the agenda than it was for most of the Bush administration. So we'll see. Yesterday, Obama announced his national security team, including Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State, Robert Gates continuing as Defense Secretary, and retired Marine General and former NATO commander Jim Jones as National Security Advisor. I want to say a few words about each of these three to round out our understanding of what kind of advice President-elect Obama may be getting from his closest foreign policy advisors when it comes to the Middle East. Hillary Clinton may be the biggest hawk of the bunch. She strongly originally supported the Bush administration's wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, and has voted for every military appropriation for the two wars, even though she called on Congress last year to repeal the 2002 Iraq War authorization. She is unswervingly pro-Israel. She favored Israel's war on Lebanon and Hezbollah in the summer of 2006, supports the separation wall Israel is building in the West Bank, and has not spoken out against the expansion of Israeli settlements in the occupied territories. Clinton has endorsed military strikes against Iran if it develops nuclear weapons. Going even further than the Bush administration, she voted with 75 senators to declare the Iranian Revolutionary Guard a terrorist organization. Nevertheless, Clinton still favors diplomacy and seeks to work with international institutions and allies more than most members of the Bush administration have. She now considers Afghanistan, not Iraq, the central front in the war on terror, and supports a military buildup there. In sum, Clinton advocates a tough U.S. foreign policy, albeit one that is committed to guaranteeing human rights at home and abroad in the tradition of Jimmy Carter. Robert Gates replaced Donald Rumsfeld as Secretary of Defense at the end of 2006. Unlike his neoconservative predecessor, Gates is seen as a moderate and has widely been praised by both Republicans and Democrats alike. He comes with extensive experience in the Middle East, having played a key role in the U.S. response to the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, in the negotiations over the Iran hostage crisis, and in the formation of U.S. policy during the first Gulf War. He promoted the military surge in Iraq, putting him on a different page than Obama, Biden, Clinton, but he agrees with the president-elect that a greater focus on Afghanistan is needed. Gates does not particularly relish his position. I was talking to somebody in the U.S. State Department the other day, and he said that when Gates came to office, he got a countdown clock that literally counted down to January 20th, 2009. But he's agreed to stay on for another year to help ease the transition and prepare for the withdrawal of troops from Iraq. Finally, Jim Jones, the former Marine general, has been a critic of some elements of the Bush administration's war strategy, arguing that a near-exclusive focus on Iraq has caused the nation to take its eye off the ball in Afghanistan, allowing for the resurgence of the Taliban and a safe haven for al-Qaeda. He has experience working with both Israelis and Palestinians, as he was appointed by the Bush administration to help institute a security model in the West Bank city of Jenin, and has been praised by both sides as successful in both reducing suicide bombings and empowering Palestinian security officials to restore order in the city. Jones, like Biden and Gates, and for the most part Clinton, is typically seen as a moderate in foreign policy circles. So all of this combined, what we see emerging then, based on the people Obama has chosen to fill top positions, is an administration that will be strikingly moderate in its foreign policy. Some liberals are critical of this. We will see a shift in focus from Iraq to Afghanistan, although that change will be incremental and may take 2 years or more. President-elect Obama will, all things being equal, probably try to keep his campaign promise of withdrawing most U.S. troops from Iraq within 16 months. The reality may well get in the way, and he may be forced to respond and adapt to changing circumstances rather than shaping them the way he might like. We will probably see renewed interest in a real peace process in Palestine-Israel, although I personally am doubtful there will be much real leadership from the White House for the foreseeable future, given the overwhelming burden of more urgent matters, namely the economy, Iraq and Afghanistan, and possibly India and Pakistan. We will probably see the administration reach out to countries that were considered pariahs during the Bush years, including Syria. Low-level and probably secret talks with Hezbollah and especially Hamas are probable. The overall theme will be one of diplomatic inclusion, trying to get as many parties to the negotiating table as possible in an effort to invite them to join the mainstream political and diplomatic process rather than relying on terrorism. While Obama will continue to use military force against terrorist groups, I think we'll see him reach out to groups that the Bush administration refused to speak with. The best case scenario, I think, is that as the Obama administration tries to include groups like Hamas, they can, with international encouragement, follow a model similar to the IRA and Sinn Féin in Ireland. And gradually, they can encourage Hamas to give up their paramilitary actions as they gain greater power to provide goods and services to their constituents through the normalized political process. Of course, what I just said is full of a bunch of ifs and buts, but it's more a possibility in the next 4 years than it has been in the past 8. That Obama intends on improving the White House's relationship with the United Nations is indicated by his appointment of Susan Rice as ambassador to the UN. She was a key foreign policy advisor for Obama during his campaign, and he intends on restoring the ambassador's post to a cabinet rank, as it was under President Clinton before being de-emphasized in the Bush administration. Rice is a strong advocate of forceful action, including military force if necessary, to stop mass killings such as we see in Darfur. And so if she has her way, this could lead to a new round of U.S. intervention around the world in humanitarian crises and situations of gross abuse of human rights. We'll most certainly see greater emphasis on international cooperation, multilateralism, consultation with friends and allies, thawed relations with uncommitted nations, and even some negotiation with enemies, though probably only at a low level for now. In short, the world should expect a return to a more robust diplomacy from the coming administration, rather than the cowboy philosophy of George W. Bush, who was happy to go it alone with only nominal or sometimes no support from allies and the broader international community, and who sometimes seemed eager to shoot first and ask questions later. But the U.S. military won't be turning its swords into plowshares anytime soon. And at some point, responding to some crisis or unforeseen development, Obama will be forced to employ force in such a way that angers some people around the globe, very likely people here in the Middle East and perhaps in Europe as well. Whether Nicolas Sarkozy will be sending love letters to the White House in 4 years' time remains an open question. That Obama has promptly but not hastily filled many of the key positions in administration bodes well for the proactive but not panicked leadership he will need to show once taking office. The thing to watch is how assertive the Obama administration will be in its first 100 days, both in terms of what it seeks to do and what it actually accomplishes in doing. Obama will come into office with the great fortune of having substantial, though not invulnerable, Democratic majorities in both the House of Representatives and the Senate. His solid margin of victory, 53-46%, and even more overwhelmingly in electoral votes, 365-173, gives him something of a mandate. Will President-elect Obama be able to push through a sweeping legislative agenda on par with Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal? Or will the agenda be more modest, either through pragmatism, temperament, or necessity? Remember John F. Kennedy, who announced a new frontier for America in 1960 and sought a wide range of domestic and foreign policy innovations, but who was often frustrated by his lack of political capital and the entrenched interests in Washington. Indeed, in many ways, Obama's historic peers are Franklin Roosevelt and John Kennedy. Both were charming, articulate, and widely popular during their presidencies. The key similarity between Roosevelt, Kennedy, and now Obama is that they are transformative political figures who shape not just the nation's policies, but also its psychology. Historians still debate as to whether or not Roosevelt and Kennedy were in fact good, effective presidents. But without much doubt, they succeeded in capturing the imagination of an entire generation, and giving people in America and around the world new meaning and hope. At this admittedly very premature moment, it seems that Obama may be cut from the same cloth. Roosevelt's vision and initiative helped reformulate and realign American politics, much as Ronald Reagan did in 1980. In future decades, will we look back on 2008 as the dawn of the age of Obama? I do believe we're witnessing the beginning of a new era in American politics, one in which a new generation of voters will bring their concerns to the table, and one in which the concerns of a previous generation of voters, most notably race, will begin to diminish in importance. Consider this. In exit polls, age was cited as a significant factor for more voters more than twice as frequently as was race. And Obama polled almost exactly the same among those voters who said that race was important, as well as those who said it was not. As a historian of American race relations, I understand as well as anyone how intricately entwined racism is in the DNA of American politics and culture. But I believe that the rising generation of American young people, the 66% who gave Obama their votes, is increasingly colorblind, especially in their personal relationships. Racism and discrimination continue to exist and even thrive in some corners of America, with the Arab and Muslim populations, along with homosexuals, now perhaps the greatest victims of widespread fear and marginalization in America. But it is not insignificant that for the first time in history, three of the four names at the top of the ballot last month were not white Anglo-Saxon Protestants. One was black, one was Catholic, and one was a woman. Time will tell, but I believe this election both stems from and will further propel a changing landscape in American politics. More significantly, it's another battle won in the nonviolent revolution that has swept across America in fits and starts over the past century. This revolution seeks to finish the work of the first revolution against colonialism and the second revolution against slavery. This continuing revolution struggles for the realization of the promise stated by Abraham Lincoln in 1863 and Barack Obama on the night of his election, that government of the people, by the people, and for the people shall not perish from the earth. How far and how fast the revolution proceeds, and how deeply it transforms the American nation and the world, is now the great question to be answered by the new occupant of the Oval Office. Thank you.